My name is David Gerhardt. I'm the lead from the Vestry at St. Francis on the Adult Christian Formation Group, which is presenting this this series. I want to extend a warm welcome to all of you from St. Francis and from the Adult Christian Formation Group. Tonight, of course, is the first of four sessions on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we'll be discussing the controversy surrounding and also the true significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. In subsequent sessions, the next one being Wednesday, October 24th, then we'll be skipping Halloween so that everybody can go out and take care of trick-or-treating. Then continuing on November 7th and November 14th at the same time, 7 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday. Tonight's activity is, of course, just one of a series of programs sponsored by the St. Francis Adult Christian Formation Group. Many of you here may remember the program that was put on earlier this year regarding Dietrich Bonhoeffer. The program that you're about to experience is timely for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, it allows you to gain an understanding historically of the significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Second, it allows us all to obtain additional insight into the significance and the meaning of biblical scripture. It also, luckily for all of us, coincides with an actual exhibit of the real Dead Sea Scrolls that's taking place now in San Diego at the Natural History Museum there. In fact, a number of us will be going down there on October 27th to look at them, which is right after the second lecture, so we'll be able to have a chance to come back and actually ask some questions about what we've seen. However, we're here to gain insight into the Dead Sea Scrolls, and our guest lecturer is eminently qualified to help us in that regard. Michael Phelps is the director of the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library and the former director of the Ancient Biblical Manuscript Center in Claremont. At the Manuscript Center, Michael oversaw the world's largest archive of photographic images of the scrolls and managed the first project to apply sophisticated digital imaging techniques to read otherwise illegible text that existed on the deteriorating scrolls. In addition, Mr. Phelps just returned from Georgia, not the one that's involved with peaches, the one that's involved with the former Soviet Union, where he was responsible for photography and digitizing of ancient Georgian Christian manuscripts from time around the time of the first millennium. And in order to get us back on schedule without further ado, please join me in welcoming Michael Phelps.
Let's see, can I be heard? Let's see, by way of introduction, I'm going to do four things this evening. The first is I'm going to give you a little commercial. And I direct a nonprofit organization, so that goes with the territory when you direct a nonprofit. You add a commercial. I'll keep them minimal, but there will be a commercial to begin with. But then after I'm done with that commercial, what I want to do first is to talk about why are the Dead Sea Scrolls significant at all? What about them, even apart from knowing what they contain, just as far as where they come from and when they come from, why are they significant? Just by way of introduction, I'll describe that. Then what I'm going to do is we're going to show some slides, and those slides will introduce you first to the context of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and secondarily to what the Dead Sea Scrolls are like physically. We've all heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We've possibly seen images of the Dead Sea Scrolls on the World Wide Web. And we've possibly seen images or drawings of the Dead Sea Scrolls in cartoons or in the Worldwide News, which is not a publication this year, and the checkout stand at the grocery store. But I want to introduce you to physically, because to understand the Dead Sea Scrolls is partly to understand the problem of working with them. They're not easy to work with. They're crunchy little agglutinized blobs of ancient leather that are falling apart and deteriorating into gelatin. So I want to give some slides to put it in context to say what are they and what are the problems of working with them. Then we're going to look, then for the bulk of our time together today, we're going to leave the ancient world and come back into, well, the 20th century, not the 21st. and talk about why did the Dead Sea Scrolls become controversial. I'm going to tell the story of their discovery and of the delays in publication that occurred that made the Dead Sea Scrolls, in the words of Gezer Emesh, an Oxford scholar, the academic scandal par excellence of the 20th century. And sometimes when I teach sessions on the Dead Sea Scrolls, some people really like the narrative of how they became controversial in the 70s and 80s. And some people say, why are we doing this? Let's just get to the significance of the scrolls, talk about their relationship to the New Testament and to ancient Judaism. Both opinions are valid, but I think it's important and it's worthwhile. We have four sessions together to spend a little bit of time in this first session, the bulk of this first session, actually, but to talk about the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And when I'm done, many of you will think we're actually going to have to probably wait for more of the original editors of the scrolls to pass on to be able to do so without controversy, but probably we need to do a TV miniseries about the discovery of the scrolls and the controversies that then dominated them for the next 50 years after their discovery. So now to the commercial, first slide. Oh, there we are. I direct a nonprofit called the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library. We're devoted to applying digital imaging technologies to preserve Jewish and Christian manuscripts that are in danger of deteriorating and then to make them accessible to scholars around the world. So that a scholar who's writing a commentary, say on the Gospel of John or the Book of Deuteronomy, doesn't need to scour the globe to go find the most important manuscripts of those texts. They can have digital access to crystal clear images of those texts. First slide. I just got back from Georgia, to Tbilisi, Georgia. This is a national institution in Georgia called the National Center of Manuscripts. You may say, why go to Georgia? It's not a country that makes the 6 o'clock news very often. But they're significant in the ancient world. They converted to Christianity in 335 AD, the second nation to convert to Christianity after Armenia. They began to build libraries of ancient documents from the very beginning in this ancient Christian culture. Because Christianity moved east before it ever moved west and got to our ancestors. And then in the 12th century, a king became king of Georgia, who's gone down in history by the name of David the Builder. And he expanded what became the Kingdom of Georgia that became the most powerful kingdom in the Near East of their time. But what he did is he imported from Byzantium, the cultural center of the ancient world, philosophers, and theologians, and mathematicians, and rhetoricians, and built academies in Georgia and great libraries. And therefore, Georgia, this little country in the former Soviet republics, has some of the greatest manuscripts we have in the world today from the efforts of David the Builder, who built these medieval libraries. This is their manuscript room, cold storage of their manuscripts. Medieval manuscripts are part of lumps. They lose the rectangular character of modern books, and they're just sort of slump on the shelf, but this is in the cold storage of their manuscripts. Next slide. For 2 years, my organization has been developing a system for digitally photographing manuscripts and caring for the binding as we photograph it. As you turn the pages of a book, the weight shifts from one side of the book to the other, causing the spine to rotate. Next slide. So with our system, we built a computer-controlled cradle that moves with the binding of a book. Because if we break a 1,000-year-old binding, the Gospel of John may fall out. And one of our 1,000-year-old copy of the New Testament, a 15-year-old copy of the New Testament, because actually the bindings are usually several centuries later than the pages, because they rebind and rebind as the books became old and needed to be rebound. But if we lose that binding, the Gospel of John falls out and is undercover, and the manuscript starts to fall apart. Next slide. Now let's go to the next slide. And that is a manuscript dated 968 AD, AD 968. It is a biography of St. Chrysostom, one of the leaders of 4th century Christianity in Greece in the Byzantine world. But it's an 1,100-year-old manuscript that was digitized on a cradle in Georgia. And that's another 1,100-year-old manuscript. So that's my commercial. We're involved in developing technology, taking that technology on site around the world, and digitizing materials to preserve them for future generations and make them accessible to scholars around the world. We're developing new projects, and I put on the back sign-up sheets. It has some red and blue letters at the top. If you'd like to subscribe to our newsletter and learn about our work, and there's going to be more slides. But if you'd like to receive our newsletter and learn about our work, please sign up. And there's some awkwardness whenever I speak in churches and synagogues all the time, and I always invite people to sign up for our newsletter. I'm a member of this parish, and it's a little more awkward to do that here. And I understand that not everyone is interested in this, and that's perfectly okay. So if you're a parishioner here and I know your name and you don't sign up, that's okay. If you're interested, please do so. So, now, let me introduce you. First, let me say, before we get to the slide, some words about why are the Dead Sea Scrolls important. If you think about the period they come from, scholars call it Second Temple Judaism. Because the temple that was built by Solomon, that we read about in the Old Testament, was destroyed by the Babylonians. Israel was a backwater in most of the ancient world. And it was stuck between Egypt to the south, which was a great world power, and Babylon to the north, which was a great world power. And it was the battlefield between these two world powers. And actually, when Israel enjoyed productivity and a strong economy, that meant that the two world powers were weak in their economy, and it gave a chance for Israel to flourish. And that actually, the glowing reign of Solomon, that's described in the Old Testament, when he built the great temple of Jerusalem and expanded the territory of Israel, the prime reason he was able to do that is because that was a moment at which the empires to the north and south were in a relatively weaker time in their economies and their militaries. But that was only a moment in the history of Israel. Normally, they were the path in which armies went back and forth, and most of their history was a history of struggle and oppression between these two great empires to the north and south. Well, in 586 BC, the Babylonians destroyed the Temple of Jerusalem. And they took the leading members of the society, the upper classes, and took them into exile into Babylon. Then the Persian Empire destroyed the Babylonian Empire, and they were not friendly people. But since the Babylonians had a policy, how do we control the subject populations of our empire? We move them around. We separate them from homeland, from tribe, from temple, and therefore we impose control. Well, the Persians also were interested in controlling an empire. And one of the ways you do that is reversing the policies of the previous empire. I don't think the Persians were friendly. They were simply trying to find a way to control populations. So they allowed the Jewish people to return from Babylon, those who wanted to. Most of them actually stayed in Babylon because they didn't like it. But they allowed people to return to their homeland in Judah, in ancient Israel, in Judah, the southern kingdom. And they rebuilt the temple. And around 515 BC, they rebuilt the temple. And that begins what scholars talk about as the Second Temple period. And that temple lasted from 515 BC to who destroyed it? The Romans. The Romans destroyed it in 70 AD. They destroyed the temple, and after another revolt from the Jews, kicked all of the Jews out of Judea, not to return to their homeland so they would not revolt again. But the Romans destroyed the temple. So we have a temple that lasted almost 600 years. And the end of that Second Temple period is when Jesus was born and had his ministry in Judea. It is when Judaism, as we know it today, took shape and form. It's when Roman and Greek culture came from southern Europe and came east conquering. And just like Napoleon would centuries later when he went to Egypt and brought obelisks back and put them in the middle of Paris, and Parisians were fascinated by the exotic cultures of the ancient Near East that were opened to them by Napoleon's armies, likewise the Romans and the Greeks, when they took their armies eastward, they encountered Semitic cultures of Babylon, Semitic cultures of Israel, and further south in Egypt. They were likewise fascinated. But this confluence of cultures, Romans and Greeks, with their educational systems, their philosophy, their nascent democracy, mixing with the monotheistic traditions of Judaism, If we want to talk in broad terms, when did Western culture, not just Judaism and Christianity, but when did Western culture itself take shape? It's in this confluence of the monotheistic traditions of Judaism and the governmental, military, economic, and philosophic traditions of Greece and Rome. And it all happened on a little piece of land in a backwater of the Roman Empire called Judea. But what documents do we have from this momentous moment in history when Judaism took shape as we know it today and Christianity was founded? What documents do we have? We have the New Testament. Some of Paul's letters were written before the temple was destroyed. And something written before the temple was destroyed is extremely critical. Because think about it. If a European historian were to write a history of European Jewry before the Holocaust, and then to rewrite their history of European Jewry after the Holocaust, they would read history differently based on an epoch-making event. Well, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem by Rome in 70 AD was an epoch-making event. And we want literature that gets behind that event, that interprets Judaism, interprets the life and land in which Jesus lived, in which the early rabbis formed Judaism as we know it today, before the temple was destroyed. We have a few of Paul's letters. Now, I'm a Christian, and I actually have a fairly high view of Scripture, and I respect the New Testament. I respect Paul's letters. But if I step away from the New Testament and look at it objectively, what is it? It's the literature of a small sect of Jews who believed that their executed leader was the Messiah and had risen from the dead. And if you read the New Testament, it's very propagandistic. It's very preachy. It's the in-crowd talking to the in-crowd. It's not a great historical source for understanding the period. And also, if you read the New Testament without any literature from the Jews of the time, it's sort of 2,000 years from now reading tracts or a platform of the Republican Party without having the Democratic platform to compare it to. And on issues like protectionism and free trade, Democrats and Republicans kind of go flip over the decades. And you can't understand one without its conversation partner. And the New Testament has no conversation partner. We don't have a single scrap of literature prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls that represents the people to whom the New Testament was talking to. The other major historical source is Josephus, the historian. He was a general in a Jewish revolt against Rome who realized it wasn't going very well and actually sort of turned to the Roman side, but he wrote a history of Judaism. But he was trying to explain Judaism to a Roman audience, and there are some problems in the way he explains Judaism to a Roman audience. And also, he's writing after the temple was destroyed, after that epoch-making event. So the problem is, from this great moment in world and history and Western cultural history, we have just about zero documents. There is nothing that archaeologists were digging up that was written in the sands of Judea for the time period of Jesus. And the reason is, up in Mesopotamia, I'm making this introduction way longer than it needs to be, but here's another detail. Up in Mesopotamia, they wrote on clay tablets. The most durable medium for information humans have ever designed is a clay tablet. And if we put all the clay tablets discovered in Mesopotamia in this room, we fill this room, and we have to go move and start building the sanctuary. It in Mesopotamia is wet, and therefore clay tablets survive. In Egypt, they wrote on perishable material, parchment and papyrus, primarily papyrus. And there, the climate is dry. We could fill this room with all the papyrus we've discovered in Egypt. The problem of ancient Judea and the culture of the Old Testament, the kings of the Old Testament had archives, they had literature, they had libraries, but they were in an environment in Jerusalem that's relatively wet, at least compared to Egypt, but they used the writing medium, so they had the climate of Mesopotamia, but they used the writing medium of Egypt. They wrote on papyrus in a wet climate. And archaeologists occasionally discover a row of clay seals in the dirt. And those clay seals would have been on the outside of a rolled scroll. But all that's left in the dirt are the clay seals, still in a row, and the scroll has turned to dust. Luckily, an ancient sect of Jews who were heterodox and radicalized in their interpretation of the Bible, they disagreed with other Jews about how to interpret the Torah, the first five books of the Bible, the Laws of Moses. They disagreed with the temple establishment over how to run a temple and how to keep it ritually pure and clean. And they had an extremely strict interpretation of Judaism, and they felt that the priests of the temple were too lax. Keep in mind, these are the people who Jesus dialogued with and are called legalists in the New Testament. But for the people who moved out to Qumran, who built a library that we call the Dead Sea Scrolls, the priests of the temple were far too lax. And were not keeping the temple ritually clean and pure because they were too lax in how they applied the laws of Moses. And if the temple was ritually impure, that means the sacrifices were inefficacious. They were meaningless. The prayers of the temple were meaningless. They hit a ceiling and bounced back. The temple was invalid. So this small band is sort of heterodox, a heterodox denomination of Jews of the time, removed themselves out into the desert of Judah next to the Dead Sea to create a life for themselves where they could realize in relative peace their distinctive vision of what it meant to be Jewish. And they built a library. And lucky for us, they did so in a very dry environment. So we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. There are two areas where the Dead Sea Scrolls have rewritten the history books, where quite literally you can take histories of the time of Jesus and introductions to the Bible and rip out some of the chapters if it was written prior to about 1960. The Dead Sea Scrolls have rewritten our understanding of Judaism at the time of Jesus. They've rewritten our understanding of the fertile ground out of which Christianity and Judaism as we know it today grew as two siblings out of common ground. Secondly, the Dead Sea Scrolls have rewritten our understanding of how the Bible came to be. We have a completely different view of how the Bible came to be, and those will be our last two sessions to talk about those two topics. Now, where did the Dead Sea Scrolls come from? You've seen the map that's behind me. Sea of Galilee, Jordan River descending to the south, the Dead Sea, lowest place in the world elevation below sea level, lower than our Death Valley. Oops, sorry. Blind anyone? Jerusalem is right out here, Jericho, and then northwest shore of the Dead Sea right there is where our community lived. Looks a lot like our Southern California desert, but it's drier. Next slide. This is called Wadi Qumran. Qumran is a modern name, not an ancient name. We have no idea what these people call themselves. They don't call them anything, themselves anything, in any of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They use one term, though, however. They call themselves the people who are entering the New Covenant. There's one place in the Old Testament where the phrase New Covenant appears. Does anybody know where that is? And if you grew up with me, like me, as a good conservative evangelical, you would know. It's in Jeremiah chapter 30, I believe, verse 31 through 33. Jeremiah says, there will be a new covenant that God makes with you, not written on tablets of stone, but written on the human heart. So Jeremiah the prophet predicts that God will make a new covenant. What does the word testament mean? What's another word for testament? Covenant. It's the New Testament is the new covenant. And if you read the book of Hebrews quotes that passage of Jeremiah and says, we have a new covenant that God has given us in Jesus. Now this, I'm getting ahead of myself, but think about it a moment. We have a community of Jews who are heterodox Jews out in the desert who are saying, we are the people entering the covenant that Jeremiah predicted. Then you have another little heterodox group of Jews, literally Christians, who are saying, no, we are the people who are entering the new covenant. If we could take a time machine back, I bet we would find other groups who are saying, we are the people entering the new covenant. So we already have a sense of the context in which Christianity rose up and competed with other groups over the same terminology. You know, who is the pro-family political party in the United States? Who is the religious group that is entering the new covenant? These are competing politics of the day. So here is Wadi Qumran. This piece that looks like a piece of broccoli, remember that. This is the community that assembled the library called the Dead Sea Scrolls. Thank you. No archaeologist would pay attention to that little set of ruins except for the cave where the scrolls were discovered. It is a little podunk place out in the desert, but they were not a sect. Next slide. They were up to the technological standards of the day. They lived a difficult life, but there were engineers in this community. This is an aqueduct. They have a dam in the cliffs above them. There was a dam, and the aqueduct directed water down into the community. They had a cistern where the water was stuck so that silt would fall out of the water to purify the water entering the community. Then the community is filled with cisterns, more to hold water than any community would need for drinking and bathing and cooking. Anybody know what would the other cisterns be?
Ritual baths.
Ritual baths. Mikvahs. Mikvahot. The ritual bath that is prescribed in the book of Leviticus that at certain times Jews would wash themselves in. There steps down and steps out down into a mikvah. Now, when these mikvahs were unearthed, Orthodox rabbis came to measure them. Because the Mishnah, the major authoritative document outside the Torah of Judaism, prescribes what a mikvah, a ritual bath, should be like. These mikvahs do not accord with rabbinic tradition. So either we have a kind of Judaism that's different than Judaism as we know it today, or we have a Judaism that's prior, still evolving, and precedes Judaism as we know it today. The answer actually is which one of those? Both. Now they have a dining room that was 72 feet long and 15 feet wide. All of the members of the community would meet at noon if you were ritually pure and in good standing in the community. You would gather at noon for a meal, and the floor of the dining room was beveled so that they could wash it and drain water after every meal, cleaning the floor. This was a well-thought-out community in the desert. And when they had their meal, the leading member of the community would break bread, drink wine, and pass it to the next member of the community, and it would be passed down according to rank in the community. And it was absolutely essential that everyone knew their rank in this community and sat in order at the ritual meal every day at noon. Next slide. This is the side of that piece of broccoli. The Dead Sea Scrolls were found in 11 caves between 1947 and 1956. This entrance, it looks like a keyhole, is a modern entrance created by erosion as water went into the cave, and then these soft limestone caves had to look for an exit and created an entrance. Of the 11 caves which the scrolls were discovered, this is the only one created by human hands. And it's right next to the community. It appears to have been their library. And the original entrance was up at the top of the cliffs in the ceiling. There were 11 caves discovered between 1947 and 1956 containing Dead Sea Scrolls. This was the mother lode. All told, there are about 900 Dead Sea Scrolls. About 600 of them came from that cave. But this cave, where in some of the other caves the scrolls were in jars. Cave 1, discovered in 1947. Cave 11, 1956, the scrolls were discovered in jars. So in those two caves, the scrolls are very well preserved for 2,000-year-old documents. But in cave 4, there were no jars. The scrolls were open to the elements. And there's only one Dead Sea Scroll that came out of Cave 4 still in the form of a scroll. And it was so fragile when scholars unrolled it, they had to tear it apart. They unrolled it by pulling it apart and trying to keep the pieces in place. No scroll came out of Cave 4 in the form of a scroll. Next slide. We've introduced you a little bit about where these things come from. Deep in the desert of Judea, a community segregating itself to realize its distinctive vision of what it meant to be Jewish, and they amassed a library of at least 900 volumes, but there are probably more in caves we haven't discovered, and there are scrolls that turned to dust and didn't make it. They probably had a library of well over 1,100 volumes, which would have been a massive library in this early time period, and we know from the scrolls that literacy was valued in this community. But now let's start looking at these scrolls. This is an extremely well-preserved Dead Sea Scroll of the Book of Leviticus. It contains about the last third of the Book of Leviticus, which means this scroll was quite big round in antiquity. But as it deteriorated, it got thinner and thinner and thinner. And we have the core. We have the last third. Now, here's a question for you. This scroll is well-preserved. We have a nice long piece of scroll that looks like a Dead Sea Scroll. If this were in fragments, what criteria could you use to put it back together again? And these are criteria you can see from where you're sitting. It's an engineering question, and I know Palos Verdes is strong in it. Shape. Now, you have a scroll that deteriorated in a reoccurring pattern of little hills and valleys. If you're on the outside of the scroll, where the leather has to wrap around a larger shape, the hill and valley is longer. As you go to the interior of the scroll, the hill and valley gets sharper and shorter. Long, short. If this fell apart, you could use that as a criteria to arrange the pieces. And those are the kind of criteria that scholars use to put Dead Sea Scrolls back together again. Next slide. This is one column from the only complete Dead Sea Scroll. It is 54 columns long, about 22 feet long, pieces of animal hide sewn together with linen thread. It is the entirety of the book of Isaiah. It's actually one of the older of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It dates to about 125 BC. Now this is going to be hard to see from where you're sitting, but there's some really nice things to point out about this scroll. So the scribe is copying this scroll of the book of Isaiah at about 125 BCE from another older copy of the book of Isaiah, which is itself a copy of a copy of a copy, going back to the prophet and his disciples who would have gathered together the sermons of the prophet and edited them together into something like what we know today as the book of Isaiah. Now, the scribe makes errors. There's no such thing as a biblical manuscript without errors in it. He missed an entire line of text as his eyes go up to the parent manuscript. In his manuscript, he's copying, he missed a line. So someone noticed the missing line, went to another scroll of the book of Isaiah in the library, brought it down, and added the missing line. And if you can see it, if you remember your school days, you're writing an essay exam for your teacher, you run out of room, and you write up the margin, here's a verse of Isaiah going down the margin. Now, you can't see it from where you're sitting, but the handwriting of that scribe is extremely poor. This is not a pro. He's not a professionally trained scribe. He's someone who can read, he's literate, but his handwriting is really bad. Now, here is another correction by a third hand, a third person. Missed another line of text. But what's interesting, in my opinion, this handwriting is better than the handwriting of the original scribe. That guy was a pro. But we have three hands, the original scribe and two people correcting mistakes. Now, I've seen someone who took photographs of this scroll of Isaiah and put them all together to reconstruct the scroll on a wall. And if you follow the scroll from beginning to end, there's about four columns, about two-thirds of the way through the scroll, where all the mistakes occur. So the scribe got tired, started to make a critical number of errors, probably took a risk, took a nap, got lunch, comes back, and finishes the scroll with pretty much no errors. But all Dead Sea Scrolls have scribal corrections and errors in them, which is why my organization is involved in digitizing manuscripts, because knowledge of scripture and scriptural scholarship begins with a critical mass of manuscripts. We need to compare them to isolate the differences, weigh those differences, and then restore the best text we can. But no one biblical manuscript is perfect. Biblical scholarship begins with comparing manuscripts. Any questions about that? Is that good? There's one little idiosyncrasy about this scroll. You definitely can't see this even with the lights off. But the first person who made a correction, well, I don't know if he was the first, but the one with the bad handwriting, he comes to the divine name. The letter name in four letters in Hebrew that observant Jews will not pronounce aloud. And out of piety, he doesn't write the name. He just puts four dots. Four little dots for the divine name. Really neat. Next slide. Here's another scroll of the book of Isaiah. This is from Cave 4, that mother load of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Cave 4, 600 scrolls. This is another scroll of the book of Isaiah. It is one of the best preserved of all of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And where you don't see scroll, there's nothing to put there. It is turned to dust. Next slide. Not only do we miss pieces of the Dead Sea Scrolls as they deteriorate, but as they deteriorate, they change in shape, so that the writing gently arcs across this scroll of the minor prophets. What are the minor prophets? Those little prophets in the Old Testament no one ever reads. Amos, Obadiah, Micah, Malachi. And the writing arcs across the scroll. Next slide. Wow. This is Cave 4. When a scholar thinks of Dead Sea Scrolls, a scholar thinks of this. There, of the 900 Dead Sea Scrolls, there are only a handful that look like a scroll. The vast majority of them are not Dead Sea Scrolls, but Dead Sea McNuggets. Now, the scholars who have them are pressing the fragments between glass to preserve them, and they're sorting. This photograph was taken in the very first stage of scholars sorting the fragments. What is the criteria that's being used to sort the fragments?
Size.
You can sort the big ones more easily. And then you can sort the little ones based on the sorting of the big ones. So we have little ones no bigger than dimes and pennies, or sometimes even fingernail shavings. And then we have larger fragments. And you don't sort them by looking at what they say or the handwriting. You sort them by the grade and quality of the animal hide, and you sort them because by the lines left in the manuscript by the scribe. The scribe would take a knife and draw vertical lines to designate the columns, and then horizontal lines to write on. And actually, they didn't write on the lines, they hang the letters down from the line. But a scribe in any particular scroll would be fairly consistent on the width of columns and the height of lines. But it's not consistent scroll to scroll. So the scholars found as objective criteria as possible to be able to sort these fragments before they looked at the handwriting or what they said. Next slide. This is a room in the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. How many have been to Jerusalem? Okay, not many of us. It's not a good time to go these days, but I'd say go anyway, frankly. But if you go, very few people ever make it to the Rockefeller Museum. It was previously called the Palestine Archaeological Museum. It was the Museum of Palestine before the creation of Israel. And now it is part of East Jerusalem and the occupied territories. And it's not well advertised, and none of my Jewish friends will go there. It's up on a hill, and you have to know it's there to find it. But it has one of the best archaeological collections in the world. And most of the Dead Sea Scrolls, well, until recently, I got to check my facts here, are in the Palestine Archaeological Museum. But this photograph was taken before 1967, so this was the territory of Jordan. And this was the scrollery, a room, a hallway, a hall in the museum in which the scholars put together Cave 4. In Cave 4, it's estimated there were 15,000 little fragments. Now think about that. 15,000 fragments. All of them brought, the Bedouin shepherds discovered Cave 4. They brought the fragments in jumbles to the archaeologists. There's no order or rhyme or reason. They're literally in paper bags and boxes when they arrived to the scholars. 15,000 pieces. And the pieces don't always, they're not like puzzle pieces that join. If you have a Dead Sea Scroll in an antiquity that's 20 feet long, normally only about 10% of it or less has survived to the modern day. So it's sort of like taking, it's been compared to taking several Sunday editions of the New York Times, tearing them into tiny pieces, taking two-thirds of the pieces and burning them, and then blowing the remaining third around a room with a fan and saying, put it all back together again. Now the work of the scholars who put it all back together again has become controversial because it took them so long. But there's one thing wrong with the popular imagination that criticizes those scholars. We have to understand the magnitude of this task. It was horrific to try to put the Dead Sea Scrolls back together again. And so, this is the scrollery, and you have plates of glass in which there are fragments. Those plates of glass in which there are fragments are on every flat surface in this room. There are more of them in these cabinets, plates of glass with fragments. Now tell me what problem is happening in this room.
We don't have all the light.
The windows are open, light is streaming in the windows. The Dead Sea Scrolls are under glass. Let's turn on some lights. We're going to look at some slides tomorrow, but that's our last slide.
Mike, why don't your Jewish friends go there?
It's in the occupied territories, East Jerusalem.
Oh, I know.
And according to the Geneva Conventions, if you occupy someone else's territory, you can't culturally rape their society. So you can't take art or archaeological finds and remove them back. So much, we can have the lights on.
Well, yeah.
No more slides.
I can try.
Now, you can't move things back home, so to speak, if you occupy someone else's territory. And much of the interesting archaeology done in the land of Israel or Palestine is done in the occupied territories. So when the archaeologists dig up the antiquities, they're not brought to museums in West Jerusalem where most of the tourists go. They're taken to the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. But because it's a Palestinian museum in East Jerusalem, it's cash poor. And the Israeli government is not pouring money into building new wings of the Palestine Archaeological Museum, now called the Rockefeller, because John D. was a big donor to the museum. So if you visit the Rockefeller, one, it has one of the most amazing archaeological collections in the world to see, but you're in a 1950s era museum with old style glass cases. It's just amazing. But then if you have a chance to leave the public area of the museum and go down the hallways where the administrators work, they literally have shelves just in hallways that used to be wide hallways, so like four people could walk abreast down a hallway in a large institution. Now the hallway, you have to go single file because they have nowhere to put all the antiquities. They're literally stacking up on shelves in the hallways, all the antiquities. Any questions? And now I'll get to actually what I intended to spend the evening talking about. Any questions about what we've talked about so far?
How are they sorting the antiquities? Are they doing a good job of putting them together, or why aren't they going into the museum?
Well, they're going into that museum because it's the only museum to put them that the Geneva Convention would allow the antiquities to go into, because it's in East Jerusalem. And the antiquities are generally being cared for very well. There are Palestinian and Israeli scholars who work in the museum. The problem is where the museum is, and therefore capital investment to help the museum and issues like that. So it's complicated. Now, any other questions about our introduction? But I hope you have a feel for the Dead Sea Scrolls now. Okay, another question.
Just real quick, I missed who you called the legalists. Was it this group or an opposing group?
The people at Qumran gave new meaning to the word legalist. Gave whole new meaning to the word legalist. I actually think they were very compassionate, too, and very charitable, but they were legalists to the core. Okay, now, we'll get into that later. Now I'm going to talk about when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered and what happened after they were discovered that made them controversial. And I have to say, it's been a while since I've given this lecture. I used to do it all the time. And the facts are not as clear in my mind as they used to be. And I gave it so many times in the past that I could give it without looking at my notes, and I know I'm going to start talking and then I'm going to lose my way because I won't refresh my mind in my notes. So if occasionally I have to just stop and find where I am, forgive me. It's November 23rd, 1947. For those of you who were alive then and I wasn't, what's going on in Israel-Palestine in 1947? The British are controlling Palestine. It's under a British mandate. And in November, the UN is debating to form a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And the debate is raging in November to come to a vote. And on Sunday, November 23rd, an archaeologist at Hebrew University by the name of Elazar Sukenk received a call from the other side of the city from an Armenian friend. This Armenian friend was an antiquities dealer. And this Armenian friend said some Bedouin discovered some manuscripts out in the desert. We think they're in Hebrew. We have no idea if they're valuable. How about if you and I get together and we have some fragments? The scrolls are down in Bethlehem, which was the economic center of Bedouin culture. Bedouin, the Arabic-speaking shepherds in the desert of Judah, who still lead and talk in a very traditional form of life. But they found these scrolls, they're injured, they're down in Bethlehem, they brought a few fragments up to Jerusalem so we could know what they are. Elazar, let's get together. Now, there is barbed wire from the British is separating the Palestinian and the Jewish inhabitants of the city. And neither Elazar Sukenik nor his Armenian friend can get a pass to go through the military checkpoints. They meet at rolls of barbed wire, talking to each other through the barbed wire, with probably some nervous British guards watching everything they're doing. The Armenian holds a fragment of a Dead Sea Scroll to the barbed wire. And Elazar Sukenik, who was going blind and had very thick glasses, is trying to stare back through the barbed wire to see that Dead Sea Scroll. He saw enough to realize instantly this was important. Because he was an archaeologist and he had dug graves, rock tombs, in and around Jerusalem dating from the time of the Roman occupation of the city, the time of the Second Temple period. And we have inscriptions in the walls of those tombs, usually at the entrance, the family name of a family tomb. And he looked at the Hebrew letters and recognized the shapes of the letters that possibly this could be the oldest piece of Hebrew writing apart from a few scattered rock inscriptions on the planet Earth. He gets his pass to go through the military checkpoints the next day and visits his Armenian friend who runs an antiquity store on the other side of the city. They look at the fragments and he realizes he has to go to Bethlehem. But Bethlehem was deep in Arab territory, and as a Jew, he would be risking his life to get on a bus filled with Arabs and Palestinians and go deep into Palestinian territory to Bethlehem. But he knows he has to do it. And he's smart. He realizes that if the UN carries the boat and creates a Jewish homeland, there's going to be a border. Bullets are already starting to fly around between Jewish and Palestinian inhabitants of the city. And once that boat is carried, it's going to be even more dangerous for him to go there. He asks his wife, "I have a pass. The Armenian will take me down there. Should I go?" And she says, "Elazar, you've got to be kidding. I don't want to lose my husband." She forbade him to go. And that night, the UN was scheduled to vote that evening. So he realizes he loses an opportunity if he doesn't go today. His son visits the family home in Jerusalem. His son didn't have the Hungarian name of his father, Sukenik. His son, like many immigrants, had adopted a Hebrew name, Yakin. Have any of you heard the name Yigael Yakin? Very important person in the founding of the State of Israel. Like his father, he was an archaeologist and a scholar, but he was also a military and political leader. And at the time, he was chief of operations of the Haganah. The Haganah was an illegal, according to the British, an illegal Jewish defensive force that was one of several precursors to the Israeli army, preparing defenses for the coming Israeli War of Independence. The reason he was in Jerusalem is he knew that a war would start as soon as the UN voted. The vote was positive. And he was in Jerusalem checking defenses to protect the Jewish inhabitants of the city. So he visits his family, making a courtesy call while he's in the city. And his dad asks him, "Should I go down to Bethlehem?" And I need to read Yagin's own description. And then we'll take a break. This is Yagin's publication. "What was I to tell him? Father asked son, should I go to Bethlehem? What was I to tell him? As a student of archaeology myself, I felt that an opportunity of acquiring such priceless documents could not be missed. On the other hand, as chief of operations of Haganah, I knew perfectly well the dangers my father would be risking in traveling to Arab Bethlehem. And as a son, I was torn between both feelings. I tried to hedge, but before leaving, son and soldier one, I told him not to go. I bade him and my mother shalom and left for Tel Aviv." The UN was scheduled to vote that evening. They decided to delay their vote one more day for further discussion. And you can imagine being Elazar Sukenik laying in bed that night. So without telling his son or his wife, he takes his pass and leaves for the other side of the city to join his Armenian friend. They board a bus. And his Armenian friend told him later he was scared stiff by the responsibility he had assumed by taking his Jewish friend to Bethlehem under those circumstances. And now there's another part that I should read to you before our break. "The next morning, I telephoned my Armenian friend and told him I was coming to see him right away. Armed with my pass, I entered military zone B once again and went straight to his antiquity store. I told him I was ready to go with him to Bethlehem." By the way, this is Sukenik's diary, translated to English by his son, Yigael Yagin, and then published parts of the diary. "We took the bus. I was the only Jewish occupant. The rest were Arabs. All of us felt the tension in the atmosphere. My friend told me later that he had been scared stiff by the responsibility he had assumed by bringing me on that journey, but it passed without incident. We arrived in Bethlehem. We made straight for the attic of the Arab house in which the antiquities dealer, Beni Salahi, lived. Among the Arabs, it is considered bad form to plunge immediately into business. And so, restraining my crude European behavior, I followed local custom and made polite queries about his health and the well-being of his family while we sipped coffee. I don't know how I managed to disguise my eagerness and impatience. I was on tender hooks all the time." Then finally his Armenian friend brings up the scrolls. He then brought out two jars in which the bundles had been found, which he offered for our inspection. They were of a shape unfamiliar to me. As a matter of fact, they're tall cylindrical jars, yay high, about this big around. Jars of that shape have never been discovered in any other archaeological dig in Israel. They appear to be scroll jars. He then carefully produced the leather scrolls. My hand shook as I started to unwrap one of them. I read a few sentences. It was written in beautiful biblical Hebrew. The language was like that of the Psalms, but the text was unknown to me. I looked and looked, and suddenly had the feeling that I was privileged by destiny to gaze upon a Hebrew scroll which had not been read for more than 2,000 years. I examined the other letters. All the while I was wondering what to do next. I wanted to buy them. I wished to take them home with me then and there. But I had no serious amount of money with me, and in any case it would take days to settle upon a price for such objects. For there is a special pattern to Arab bargaining, and a quick deal has no flavor. I therefore told the dealer that I was much interested, would probably wish to buy, but I should take them home with me for further scrutiny. I promised to let him know my decision to our mutual Armenian friend within 2 days. He agreed and wrapped the scrolls in paper. Tucking them under my arm, we parted with friendly salaams. While I was examining these precious documents in my study, the late news on the radio announced that the United Nations would be voting on the resolution that night. My youngest son, Mati, who later became a pilot and was killed in action on a mission against an Egyptian warship, was in the next room, twiddling radio knobs in an effort to get New York. He was tuned into the United Nations and was following the speeches before the vote. From time to time, he would give me brief commentary on what had been said. It was past midnight when the voting was announced, and I was engrossed in a particularly absorbing passage in one of the scrolls when my son rushed in with a shout that the vote on the Jewish day had been carried. This great event in Jewish history was thus combined in my home in Jerusalem with another event, no less historic, the one political, the other cultural. And let's pick that up and continue the story in about 7, 8 minutes, 10 minutes. But let's get back at about 10 after 8. There's coffee, some refreshments, and stretch our legs.